Welcome back to Shattering Myths. When we left off, we were just reading about how in Exodus 12, Yahweh tells us that anyone who is uncircumcised shall not partake in or be nourished by the Passover. Now, you know, Passover is not something you're interested in. I would say most Christians aren't. Then fine. You know, you're not interested in Passover. You're not interested in alleviating yourself of death. All right, that's your call. Go on, be fine. But if you are, if you know, partaking in and being nourished by Passover is something that interests you, something that's important to you, you have to be circumcised. And then we have Yahweh telling us there is only one Torah, and that it exists for both the naturally born and for the visitors from different countries and cultures. So the same Torah that applies to the Jews, to use the common vernacular of today, applies to the Gentiles. Again, not in that you have to follow it, but if you choose to engage in Yah's covenant, then this Torah applies to you. You know, again, it's important to note, Torah does not mean law. You know, you're going to see that in every English translation, but that is not what it means. Do some research. Examine it. Torah is teaching and instruction, guidance. It's, you know, guidance from our Father. And it's guidance, you know, mapped to his house.
You actually meant out on a really good metaphor, if you think about it, because, well, I guess as a Christian, I always heard my parents taught that the Word was God and the Word was with God at the very beginning. And so I still think that that's true. And the Word was the Torah, though. So if you think about it, the Messiah was the walking, living, breathing Torah. And so really for them to not like the Torah kind of equates to not really liking the Messiah, because that was, in essence, what he did is he kept everything perfectly, and it's like the Torah made flesh.
Exactly. Well, yeah, good example. You know, expounding upon that metaphor, you know, if the Torah is law and Yahusha, or, and use the Christian vernacular according to the, you know, Christian, Jesus, if Jesus is the Word, and the Word is the Torah, and the Torah is law, what would that make him? It'd make him a lawyer. It'd make him a judge. It would make him, you know, this legalistic guy. Now, when you read in the Greek text, when it describes his life, does he seem like that to you?
Oh, no. No, no.
No.
Not at all.
The teaching and instruction, guidance, that fits perfectly. So this idea that Torah is law is just, you know, it's ridiculous in the context of how it's used. It's ridiculous in the, you know, breakdown of the Word. It's just, it has no, it is teaching and instruction. It's, like I said, it's a map. It's guidance. It's the map from here, this imperfect world, to Yah's world. And, you know, if you want to follow it, you follow it. You don't have to follow it. You know, there are millions of people on the planet who have no interest in following it, and quite frankly, God doesn't care. He's not up there going to shed a tear because they've chosen not to follow his path. He doesn't know them. They don't know him. He doesn't want to know them because they don't want to know him. Now, those that want to know him, he provided his Torah, his teaching, his instruction, his guidance. And if we follow that and we observe that, we will end up with him. And those are the people he's interested in, those that want to know him. Now, really, Yahweh has used a term before, you know, unrequited love. Unrequited love is the most draining and, you know, difficult thing in the world. And Yahweh's not going to subject himself to that. If you don't love him, he's not going to sit there and obsess on it. He's going to look to those who do love him and be with them. Makes sense.
That's his only healthy.
Yeah, exactly. So we have the one Torah. And then we go on to read, and all of the children of Israel, the individuals who strive and contend with, who engage and persist with, who are set free and empowered by God, acted upon and did, celebrated, actively engaged and profited as Yahweh had instructed Moshe and Aaron. And then, and Moshe and Aaron likewise did the same. And then it happened, in this essential and substantive day, Yahweh came to bring out the children of Israel. So this was at the very beginning of the first fulfillment of Passover. So that, you know, we've just read through, let's just kind of, I'm going to recap this whole section again real quick. And Yahweh spoke to God, spoke as God unto Moshe and Aharon. He said, the prescribed ordinances of Passover is not for every strange estranged and foreign child to partake in. But every servant, every individual who chooses to be included and adopted, and who is circumcised at that time, he may partake in it and be nourished by it. Temporary residents and hired workers are not to partake in it or be nourished by it. Inside one's home and with one's family, it will provide nourishment. You shall not go outside of the family and home, taking the flesh outside of the family. And you shall not break or sell its bones. The entire community and witness of Yisrael shall actively engage, celebrate, and profit from this with him. And indeed, when the guest or a guest who is living with you and the visitor who is from a different place or culture acts upon and actively engages in, thereby celebrating Passover, to approach Yahweh, every male must be circumcised for him to reach this goal and for him to approach and present himself. And then, at that time, he may approach so that he may celebrate, actively engage in, and do this. And then he shall be considered the same as a native-born member of the family, grafted and rooted in to the land. But anyone who is uncircumcised, he shall not partake in it or be nourished by it. Only one Torah shall exist for the naturally born person and for the visitors from different countries and cultures who live as guests in your midst. And all of the children of Yisrael acted upon and did as with relationally Yahweh had instructed. Moshe and Aaron likewise did the same. And then it happened in this essential and substantive day. Yahweh came to bring out the children of Yisrael. Shemoth, Exodus 12, verses 43 through 51. So that's pretty condemning. If you want to participate in Passover, you must be circumcised. There are no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And, yeah, a lot of people will try and bring up, well, you can't keep Passover perfectly, so therefore it doesn't matter if I'm circumcised, I can still celebrate Passover. But the thing is, Yah didn't say, you know, if you don't get a perfect unblemished lamb, you can't participate in Passover. He didn't say that if you don't have unleavened bread, you can't participate in Passover. The only thing he said you have to have done in order to be able to not, you know, the only excluding factor was that you were not circumcised. That was the only thing he said would exclude you from benefiting from Passover.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting that at the beginning, anyone who chooses to be included and adopted. So free will is protected, but then with that free will and that choice, we do have a responsibility to follow through with what God is asking of us. As almost, I think you said it before, like our signature on the covenant or something.
Yeah, the circumcision is, you know, circumcising our child is our signature on the covenant. It's our, you know, he calls it the sign. You know, the sign of the covenant. And it's our agreement to raise our child in the covenant. It's our agreement to try and live our lives in the covenant. And, yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I should correct myself. There are really two requirements to participate in and benefit from Passover. One is that you want to. If you don't want to, you don't have to. You know, like I said, God's got a free will. You don't want to participate in the covenant? Fine. You don't want to participate in Passover? Fine. But if you want to, there's one other requirement. You must be circumcised. You know, it's not too much to ask. And, you know, one of the things we're going to talk about a little later on the show, and we'll get into it then, is, you know, it is a benefit. You know, being circumcised is not a negative factor. There are a lot of health benefits associated with circumcision. So, we'll get into that a little later, hopefully. So, yeah, there are two requirements to participating in Passover. Desire, and then being circumcised.
Now, what is the significance of waiting until the eighth day? Because in most hospitals, I think they normally just, after you have a male child, unless you specify otherwise, they normally just circumcise them right there because it is healthier for all of the health benefits. So for someone who didn't wait on the eighth day, is there any special significance in that?
Well, the reason for the eighth day is there's two different reasons, really. There's the physical reason. Yeah, I tell people there's most everything Yah said, there's a physical and a spiritual aspect. And with this, it's the same way. There's the physical aspect, why wait till the eighth day? Actually, it's kind of funny. Our brother-in-law is at med school right now, and I sent him a copy of this. He sent me some information on it. And this is one of the things, let me read it for you, that he sent me the other day talking about this. He says the protein needed for the coagulation of blood isn't there isn't enough of it available until after the seventh day. Let me see if I can read this. So I'm going to try and pronounce some of these words. Colonic bacteria synthesis is a significant portion of humans' vitamin K needs. Newborns often receive a vitamin K shot at birth to tide them over until the colons become colonized after a 5 to 7 day age consumption of their mother's milk. So they don't, this vitamin K is in there, their blood won't coagulate. Nowadays, you know, in ancient times, they didn't have that. You know, you couldn't just give a kid a vitamin K shot and, okay, no problem, they're going to coagulate. Now they do. They'll give the kids a vitamin K shot and then they'll circumcise them right there and it's not a problem. But if Moshe had, you know, or Abram had circumcised his son on the first day of his life, that kid probably would have bled to death.
You know, his son is obviously back then, Yah knew all of that stuff, even though we didn't. He knew that we didn't know that, so it's more for health reasons than anything else.
Exactly. Yeah, like I said.
But also, is it Tabernacles is one of the only festivals that is 8 days long?
Exactly. Now you're getting into, like I said, the physical and the spiritual aspect. And the spiritual aspect is what eight represents. In scripture, numbers come up a lot. And, yeah, probably the most, God's favorite number is seven, which is a combination of six plus one, man and God. And eight is what comes right after seven. So what comes after perfection, and that's eternity. Mm-hmm. Eight is representative of eternity, infinite. Yeah, even if you look today, the mathematical symbol for infinity is just an eight on its side. So, yeah, it represents eternity. And we'll get into the whole aspect of tabernacles when we come back. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we left for the commercial break, we were discussing the significance of having circumcision be performed on the eighth day. We talked about the physical aspect, which is that a child prior to that could not coagulate the blood and would bleed to death, likely. And, yeah, we talked about how nowadays the shot can be given that allows that to happen, and they'll often circumcise the kid on the first day. But we were also discussing the significance spiritually of the eighth day and how eight in Scripture represents infinity or eternity. And you brought up the fact that there is one of the festivals which is 8 days long. You know, we have Passover is 1 day, then Unleavened Bread is 7 days, Purim is 1 day, Seventh Sabbath is 1 day, Trumpets is 1 day, Yom Kippurim is 1 day, and then we reach the destination, which is Sukkah, shelters. And shelters is interesting because the presentation of it breaks it down in terms of the 7 day. Then it says there's an extra day or an extra festival, a chog, on the eighth day. So it breaks it down into the seven, and it's a 7 day festival. But then it says on the eighth day there is a festival feast as well. That is the continuation of it. And eight, like I said, represents eternity. And eight would be representing we have the seven steps of these festivals, with the last one being the destination, and that one lasts for eternity. You know, Sukkah, when it is fulfilled, will not be a one-time fulfillment. It is going to last for all of eternity. And another interesting part of that, though, comes back to what we call, Christians interpret, took this pagan holiday of Christmas and adopted it, and they call it the birth of Jesus. And we know for a fact he was not born on December 25th, and we can actually tell you exactly when he was born, because he told us, to quote in English translation, John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh, and the flesh tabernacled with us. And that is exactly what happened. He was born on the festival of tabernacles. And, which is Sukkah. Sukkah is the Hebrew word, tabernacles is the English word. And so if he was born on the first day of tabernacles, when would he have been circumcised?
On the eighth day.
Which would have been the last day of tabernacles.
Yes.
So I don't, if I know Yah, that's not a coincidence. And so that's why the eighth day is important. Yah could have said on the ninth day, on the tenth day, on the 12th day. Yeah, any day after eight would have worked. But he said the eighth day because of that correlation with eternity and infinity. By choosing to circumcise our kid, we are putting them on the first step to eternity with Yah. So, and in keeping with that, you know, moving into the rest of our verses, the next time we come across circumcision is in Kara, or Leviticus 12, verse 2. And we're not going to get into it, but it's just a repetition of what we already read, where he instructs us to circumcise on the eighth day. And again, it's circumcised of the flesh. Because one of the other arguments that you'll hear a lot is that circumcision of the flesh is not what's important. It's circumcision of the heart, which just doesn't hold up when you look at all these times where Yah specifies. Yeah, of all the ones we've had now, have you seen one that said it's circumcised of the heart?
No, not in any of those that we just read.
Now, have pretty much every one of the ones we read with Yah had circumcision of the flesh?
Mm-hmm.
And even more specifically, circumcision of the flesh of the foreskin. So, yeah, this, oh, circumcision of the heart is what matters. It's part of this whole, you know, Pauline idea of over-spiritualizing everything, where everything's got this super spiritual meaning, and that's all that matters. And, you know, like I said, everything Yahweh says, at least everything I've come across, I may, there may be something that isn't, but there's always a physical and a spiritual aspect to it. And
right.
Circumcision is the same. Yeah, there is a, yeah, we will read it. You know, it talks about circumcision of the heart, and that is important because we are told that we need to be circumcised of the heart. But that isn't something we can do. Yeah, I can't circumcise my child's heart. I can't circumcise my own heart. Yah can. And Yah will. And he tells us how to do that. So, but what we're talking about here is the circumcision of the flesh. So, and a lot of Leviticus is reiterating stuff that was already mentioned in Genesis and Exodus, but it's more codified. It's more listed out in that way there. So that's kind of what Leviticus does. So, and when we return, we'll pick up in Kara, Leviticus 19, and we'll go to verse 23. Welcome back to Shattering Myths Radio. When we left off, we've been discussing the topic of circumcision, which is our topic for the day. And if you listened to the first hour, I mentioned that Yada and I did a show on this about 3 years ago, and what we did was we looked up every word, every time the word mul, which is the word for circumcision in Hebrew, was used. And I pointed out that to our shame, we didn't think to look up every time the word arel, or uncircumcised, was used. And I did that this time, and I found a few things that, you know, like I said, I feel bad, I feel like an idiot that I missed this to begin with, because it's really interesting when you start looking at some of the times Yah uses the word for uncircumcised and how he uses it. Because it isn't always speaking just of being uncircumcised of the flesh. It's not just to say that this child was uncircumcised or anyone who is uncircumcised. It's often used as a metaphor. Or I guess that would, metaphor would be what you would call it. I'm not an English grammar person, so correct me if I'm wrong. But this is where we're going to pick up in Kara Leviticus, verse, chapter 19, verse 23. And we're going to look at an example of this, because this is really interesting. I'm just going to read from an English translation. I didn't have a chance to amplify these myself. I have looked up the most pertinent words, but it's just a very basic English translation of it, not fully amplified. But it says, "And when you come into and enter the land and plant all of the food trees, count or consider as unharvestable unacceptable for harvest, literally regard as uncircumcised foreskin, its fruit for 3 years. It exists to you as uncircumcised, forbidden, not to be eaten." So Yah here is equating fruit that is unharvestable, something that's not to be picked or eaten yet, as being uncircumcised. Now, can you tell me why do you think I found this verse so interesting and so important?
Because of the uncircumcision having to do with the fruit, so it's not really talking about, well, because it's not ripe, it's not ready.
Well, that's true, but is there a harvest you can think of that's important to Yah?
Oh, well, yes.
There's the Teruah harvest, what is errantly known as the rapture. You know, in the Greek, it's, you know, it's a harvest. It's a harpazo. And if you are considered unharvestable or literally uncircumcised, is that the position you want to be in when Yah comes to harvest his family?
You.
Exactly. So that's why I found this interesting. Yah equating uncircumcised foreskin to being unharvestable. Calling something that is unharvestable uncircumcised. Now, he could have used unharvestable. There's our word for harvest in Hebrew, and then you can negate it using lo. So he could easily have said it's unharvestable. But he chose, and Yah's a wordsmith, and Yah, he's the greatest communicator in the world. I don't think he did it just to be flippant. And, he chose to use the word arel, uncircumcised, to equate with being unharvestable. So, I don't tend to think God does a lot of things by accident. I think he has a reason for everything he does. And there is a reason he used that there. And keep in mind, this isn't, a lot of people will try and say, well, that's, this is what I found when I looked this up in different lexicons, and mainly one of my favorites to use is the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament. And, there's basically two ways people translate this and people look at this. And one is that it's was an Israeli colloquialism. It was just a phrase that they used to communicate this. But, was this an Israeli speaking this? Was this a Jew speaking this? Or was this Yahweh speaking? Now, this is written in Yahweh's voice, is it not?
Yeah, that's how I took it.
So, would Yah use a Jewish colloquialism in his message to the world? Because he's done told us the Torah is for everyone, not just for Jews. So, he would not use something that would, confuse others. Unless you think, which I think the Christian mindset is that God messes with us. Now, unless you think God is messing with us, there's a reason he chose his word. And we should be mindful of that. And so if you are uncircumcised, you are unharvestable. And, I looked up this to see how English translations dealt with it. Like I said, there's two schools of thought on it, and that's, one is that it is related to, just a colloquialism, and the other is that it means what it means. And so, just interesting to read it in those terms.
Yeah.
Like I said, when you consider the harvest of saved souls and whether or not you want to be a part of that, it's interesting for me. I'll let people draw the conclusion they choose. We'll move on now to Kara, Leviticus 26:41, and Yah speaking of those who have walked contrary to him being or humbling their uncircumcised heart and returning to his Torah. So, again, while not speaking of in a physical sense, he is using it. Would you say this was a positive or a negative use of the word?
A positive or negative? Negative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is akin to Moshe saying his lips are he has uncircumcised lips. It's a very negative connotation. Only this time, instead of Moshe using it to describe himself, Yah is using it to describe those who have left his Torah. So, again, Yah using uncircumcised, RL, in a very negative way. Then we come to, that's all of the verses in Kara, which deal with it. We come to Dabarim, which is Deuteronomy, errantly translated into English. And we'll start
What does circumcised mean again?
Circumcised?
I mean, not in the actual act, but like in the context of an uncircumcised heart. So what is the definition of circumcised?
Let me find that. I got it down here. 1 second. And then, lost that, please. Arel, the stubborn, unrepentant, unhearing, and unresponsive.
Oh, okay.
So it would be saying...
I remember reading that. I'm sorry, I couldn't find it.
Yeah, so like I said, even look at that. The fact that the word for uncircumcised carries all of those negative connotations. There isn't a positive connotation amongst that.
No, well, and it's very fitting for people who kind of balk at the idea of circumcision are very stubborn and unchanging and willing to do it.
Exactly. You mean, you look at it, you know, most of the time I come across this as people who are following Paul. And, you know, that's why,
right.
You know, that's why this subject is so important is, a little aside, you want to kind of share something is, you know, the way I came to be friends with and know Yada is, you know, I read his works, I found them online, I read them, I listened to them on the radio, but when he was doing his series on Questioning Paul, which was during the writing of Questioning Paul, he had asked for people to help edit it. And myself and a few others volunteered. And, yeah, at first, there's something a lot of people don't realize is when he first started writing Questioning Paul, it was a defense of Paul. It was being written to show how Paul was being misinterpreted, being twisted, and, you know, that what Paul really meant was this, and it was in line with Torah. You know, it was a defense of Paul. You know, Yada actually said that he really related to Paul. He saw a lot of himself in Paul in those terms. And, you know, the whole redemptive story, that he was real religious and left that and found God, and, you know, that part of it Yada related to. But it was as he went through that he realized that, you know, it was indefensible. And like I said, I was one of the people that volunteered to help him edit it. And because of that, any challenge I had got put in there. He'd send me the chapter. I'd read through it. I'd note in the side, get a challenge, point out inconsistencies, anything I could find. Now I would say I played devil's advocate, but at the time I really, you know, these were challenges. These were things that, you know, I had. Because when he first started saying that Paul was a false apostle, I was, you know, no way, that can't be right. Yeah, you got to be missing something. And I was sitting there writing, going, defending Paul. And while he answered everyone, I'd send it to him with all these comments and, you know, challenges, and then I'd get a copy back a week and a half, 2 weeks later, and he'd have addressed every single one of them. And even then, I still wasn't entirely convinced. And what actually convinced me was, as I said earlier, you know, my side project, my pet project has been to try and do an amplified translation of the Torah, starting in Genesis. And as luck would have it, coincidence would have it, whatever, I happen to be translating the Genesis 17 verses we discussed earlier at the exact same time that Yada was. And, you know, that was what convinced me, was when I read what Yahweh wrote in Bereshit 17, I was undeniable. There's no denying Yah's position on circumcision. And then I got the chapter from Yada, which was where Paul attacks circumcision. And I'm like, well, there's no way around this now. You know, everything else I could be like, oh, well, Paul meant was this. And, you know, if you look at it like this, what he's trying to say is, and I could do that with everything until I got to the circumcision part. And when Paul attacked circumcision, I'm like, well, wait. Yeah, what Paul said is clear as day. You cannot come up with, well, what Paul means is this. I mean, Paul said that if you are circumcised, the Messiah profits you nothing. He said that if you are circumcised, you are indebted to complete and fulfill every aspect of the Torah. And there is no getting around his view on circumcision. Yeah, the whole Jerusalem summit was all about his view on circumcision and saying that the, you know, Gentiles who wanted to be part of it didn't need to be circumcised. And everyone, you know, the apostle going, wait a minute, we need to talk. So there is no, you know, this is one thing where, you know, there's two things that I found that you cannot twist Paul to fit Torah. And circumcision is one of them. And I came across that at the same time that I got that chapter, and I was just like, okay, I got to let go. Paul's wrong. And, yeah, that was, you know, from that point on, I was like, okay, there's no more defending this guy. And he guaranteed everything else I'd had as well, so that was why I dismissed Paul. And that's why the circumcision topic is something that I find so important. And because it's we'll talk about it more when we get back. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. When we left, I was talking about why the topic of circumcision is so important to me and why I've chose to do this and dedicate this. And that's because that was what caused me to finally acknowledge that I could no longer defend Paul. And I was hearing, I actually lost several friends on this topic because they refused to, acknowledge Paul was wrong. And to me, what they did mostly was what I did, which was twist what Paul said and make it fit the Torah, which I'm like, okay, you can do that. But then when we'd come up with a topic of conversation turned to circumcision, they would start twisting the Torah to fit Paul. And it just became to where that was coming up all the time. And we just kind of stopped talking because of it. And I haven't talked to them in several years now. And it's because, you know, they sided with Paul on this. And for me, I couldn't, you know, every time it would come up, we'd end up talking about it because of that. And, you know, when you start twisting the Torah to fit Paul, that's where I have an issue. You know, you can twist Paul all day long. And if you want to make Paul fit Torah, go for it. To me, it's just too much mental gymnastics. But if you're going to twist what God said to make it fit what Paul said, that, you know, we can't move beyond that. So that's why this topic of circumcision is so important to me. And that's why I think it's important to love it. You know, I said there are two aspects of Paul's message that are completely incongruous with the Torah, with incongruous with Yah's message. And that is two things that you have to either dismiss Paul or twist what God said to fit Paul to, you know, avoid. And that is circumcision and his two covenants. Yeah, when you read Yah's word, it's clear there is one covenant. There is only one covenant. There will only ever be one covenant. And when he starts speaking of two covenants, there's no defending that. So those are the two issues. Go ahead.
I was just agreeing with you. Sorry.
Sorry. All right, so moving on, we're in Devarim, Deuteronomy 10, verse 16. We are instructed, wait, did I skip one here? No, yeah. So we're instructed by Yah to circumcise the foreskin of our heart and to harden our necks no more. And I'll read this in a English translation. Give you a couple
of words. Harden our necks no more?
Yeah. So I'll give you a little context. I'll read it from the, now, this isn't a translation. I'm not endorsing this, so please don't think I'm endorsing this, but the English translation I use as a go-to just because it doesn't have, you know, the Lord everywhere. It's the IRS, International Scripture Research Institute, Scripture version. And you start with the 15th verse. Yah were delighted only in your fathers to love them, and he chose their seed after them, you above all people, as it is today. And you shall circumcise the foreskin of your heart and harden your necks no more. For Yahweh, your Elohim, is Elohim of mighty ones, master of masters, and the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality nor takes a bribe. So, you know, here, because it's not speaking of a physical circumcision, it's speaking of circumcision of your heart, and equates that with being accepting of Yah. So if you want to be accepting of Yah, you will circumcise your heart. Again, circumcision is used in a positive way, while every instance of uncircumcised we've seen has been in a negative way. Going on again about the circumcision of our hearts, and Devarim 30, verse 6, we see Yahweh speaking of restoring the relationship, and he says he will circumcise our hearts. So again, circumcision being used in a positive way. And, you know, this time it's Yah saying, not telling us to circumcise our hearts, but saying he will do it. So, again, circumcision, positive. The next time we see it is outside of the Torah or inside the Torah, depending on how you view it, because there could be an argument made that Joshua or Yahusha was writing Torah, but we're not going to get into that here. But in Yahusha 5, verses 1 through 10, it explains that prior to entering the promised land, Yah had Yahusha circumcise everyone. Yeah, it explains that all those who came out of Egypt had been circumcised, but those that were born on the way were not. So Joshua circumcises them all, and then they camp out and enjoy the Passover before they enter the promised land. So, you know, the promised land, Israel throughout Scripture, is a metaphor for, you know, Yah's home in heaven. So before they were able to enter it, they had to be circumcised. And we'll continue. We'll pick up in Leave Isaiah when we return.